This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2024 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us at Socialism 2025, which will be held in Chicago next summer, July 3rd through the 6th, 2025. If you are ready to put ideas into action and get organized with others from across the country and the world, make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
Hello, everyone, and welcome. Thank you so much for joining our session on this beautiful afternoon. We're all excited. All of us are excited to be here in Chicago, city of Fred Hampton, of Lorraine Hansberry, of Gwendolyn Brooks, home of the first national labor strike, epicenter of the fight for the 8-hour workday, and my favorite city in the whole wide world in the summertime. Because my goodness, I love me some summertime shy. All right, so our objective here today is to share how the state has used forcible separation of black children from their families as a tool for over 400 years. We're going to talk a little bit about the burgeoning movement to abolish the family policing system, dispel commonly held myths about what the state calls child welfare, and we accurately call family policing, and why it is critical to situate family policing abolition alongside the movements to abolish prisons and other carceral systems, especially in a time when cross-movement solidarity is essential. So I want to start by introducing this brilliant panel, my friends, my comrades, my colleagues. We'll start with you, Alan. And can each of you share your name and how you came to this work, maybe even a little bit about how and when you became an abolitionist? Shout out to Derricka Purnell. Let's start with Alan.
Hey, everyone.
Hi, everyone. I'm Alan Detlef. I'm one of the co-founders of the Up In movement, which launched in 2020 as an abolitionist movement to abolish the family policing system. And I came to this work really through my practice background as a social worker, where I started working in the family policing system in the late 1990s, early 2000s. And my role in that system was what the system calls an investigator. So I was responsible for investigating allegations of maltreatment and then in many cases forcibly separating children from their homes. And when I was doing that work, I really thought that I was doing good. I thought that I was saving children from their horrible abusive parents. And that's really the way that everyone in that system is brainwashed to believe through all of the training and the socialization that you get in the system. It wasn't until after I left the system that I really realized how much harm I cause to families, as well as my complicity in all of the biases that are present in that system. So that led to a long time of me coming to understand my complicity in harm that I cause many children and families, and thinking through how what can be done about that when there's really no accountability process, because there's not a way for me to find the people that I forcibly separated and make any kind of amends to them. So part of what I do now is related to my understanding of my complicity in harm, and that's really what kind of drives me in the system now.
Hi, everyone. I'm Maya Pendleton. I use she, her pronouns. I originally came to this work as somebody who attempted to or thought I was attempting to make changes to this system, not realizing that it was part of a larger carceral state. I think that, you know, a lot of what we'll talk about today is how other systems that harm children and families and communities are made pretty clear by their names and their practices and what they do. But I think this system in particular sort of flies under the radar, in that it doesn't feel necessarily, at least initially, like it is a system that is active in policing and punishment. So I worked for a long time with foster youth who are currently experiencing the system, and became super frustrated by their experiences of the system And none of them really, you know, had good things to say about this so-called helping system. And most of them, more than anything, either wanted to be returned home or wanted to figure out ways to get them home safely or get their families the supports and things that they needed. This led to me being involved in many reform efforts for a long time. Before I realized that this was a system that actually cannot be reformed and is so harmful that it needs to be actually destroyed. And so I think that, you know, working both with people who have experiences of this system and also trying to work within the system made it very clear to me that this is a system that needs to end. And yeah, that is sort of how I came to this work. Josie?
Hi, everyone. My name is... That sounded very loud. Maybe I need to...
It's okay.
Oh, that was good. Oh, okay. I'm like, hello, hello, hello. Hello, my name is Josie Pickens. I go by she, her pronouns. I am the program director of Up In Movement. I come from a background of community organizing. So some of my work initially was, you know, police and prison reform, because most abolitionists begin as reformists, right? That is the way that we're taught that we can help people. I moved into more mutual aid work, and I realized while I was doing a lot of mutual aid in communities that I was working really hard to help keep people out of systems, particularly the family policing system, which we call the child welfare system. So through mutual aid work, we figured, hey, if we can help people meet their needs. Because a lot of families who end up in this system as a result of what the state usually calls neglect, right? Which is usually connected to need, poverty, a lot of times. So through that mutual aid work, I realized, oh, we are trying to help folks avoid this system because we realize that it's not a helpful system. But it wasn't until my good friend and comrade Jason Oliver, who is here, told me about Up In, and I joined Up In, that I realized the harm that the system does. So not only is it not a helping system, but it actually is a very harmful system, and learned a great deal about the history of this system and so many different things that I had no idea about, just as a regular quote-unquote citizen and even as an organizer who was organizing in underserved communities. So yes, that's how I got here and joined forces with these wonderful folks on stage today.
Thank you so much, Josie. I just realized I didn't introduce myself. my name is Connie Warren. I use she, her pronouns. I am an advisor with the Up In Movement. I also work with the Abolitionist Law Center. So I'm on both the family policing side and the prison abolition side, and have learned very much how deeply intertwined they are. All right, so I realize there's probably various levels of experience and knowledge in the room. Just by show of hands really quick, who has heard of like the term family policing as opposed to child welfare? Okay, good, yes. Let's go, narrative change. Okay. but what we're going to do, though, is start with some level setting. We're going to talk about what family policing is. So one of my favorite things to talk about, one of the things we've worked really hard at with the Up In Movement, is language. Language is such a large part of any movement, whether we're reclaiming language, creating new language, or rejecting the language that the state has given us. So starting with Maya, can you each talk about the language you use to refer to the child welfare system and why?
Yeah, I mean, I think most obvious, we use the term the family policing system to talk about the ways that families are policed by the system. But I think also what's been really important and crucial in the growing movement to end this system is using language like surveillance when we're describing the care that people are receiving through social workers, when we're describing family separation actually as an act of punishment often. So I think, you know, in describing the system in these words that are so clearly carceral, right? But, you know, if you talk to a social worker, they would say that the family isn't following a case plan, but we're able to understand that case plan as surveillance, or we're able to understand CPS workers as an arm of the police, often working in concert with the police. I think that this language really clarifies what families know that they are experiencing at the hands of the system. And so beyond just family policing, what I love a lot about the work that has been done in this space is the work to make really clear what's happening through these terms that are much more accurate to describe what families are encountering on a daily basis.
I agree. I think one of the biggest things that I think about with reference to language is making sure that we remove this language of care when we're talking about this system. Care and welfare, right? Even when we're talking about the foster system, for instance, removing that word care, especially when you learn more and dig deeper and you look at all of the data and statistics that go into what actually happens in foster systems, and you recognize that care just really isn't at the root of that. Care has never been at the root of anything that happens within this system. It's never been a quote-unquote welfare system or a system that is designed to consider and think about the welfare of children or families. So that is something that I try to push often, because I think that when we use that type of language, it just allows the system to continue to present this inaccurate perception of what it does.
I'll just add one thing quickly about that in the spirit of narrative changing. I think it's important to acknowledge where the term came from. If you've been involved in this work for a long time, you may have heard of the term family regulation system, which was kind of used before family policing. The words or the term family policing system really came from two doctoral students, Victoria Copeland and Brianna Harvey, who were both working with Dorothy Roberts. She was on both of their dissertation committees, and they talked about the idea that what this system does is really more than regulation, because of the surveillance aspects, because of the punishment aspects. So it was Victoria and Brianna that came up with this idea of family policing system, and that's how it got to Dorothy, that's how it got to people like me and many of the other people who call it family policing now. But I just wanted to acknowledge that it really came from Victoria Copeland and Brianna Harvey.
Thanks for that, Alan. Yes, hashtag cite black women, right? All right. Next question. So related to using more accurate language, there are a lot of myths about the role that the family policing system plays in our communities. So why don't we go through some of these important myths? But first, by show of hands in the audience, who has thought of the child welfare system as benevolent, helping either today or in the past? Yes. Uh-huh. Look at that. So my grandmother would say the devil is busy. But it's always and never surprising to see how effectively the state peddles its lies, right? So let's start there. The child welfare system is a helping system. Alan?
I'm going to take that one in the sense that, and Josie talked about this a little bit already, but this is probably the biggest myth that the state tells us, that this system is not just necessary, but indispensable in saving children from harm. The reality of this system, though, is that more than 70% of children who are in foster care right now are in foster care because of what the state calls neglect, which is largely related to concerns of poverty. Only less than 15% of children in foster care today are in foster care because of any type of harm, physical harm, sexual harm. So when you really look at what the system does, the system is forcibly taking children from their parents because of poverty, and then giving those children to strangers, and then paying those strangers money to take care of someone else's children, when all those children's parents really need is money. So it's not helping them. And the system actually has no means of helping families with their issues of poverty. The system isn't able to give money to anyone. A common way that children wind up in foster care is when a parent has to make a very difficult decision between going to work and leaving her child at home alone, or staying at home with her child and then being fired from her job and then not being able to pay for housing or food. What does that parent need in that situation?
Money
or childcare, really. money to pay for childcare or just childcare that's free and accessible. The family policing system has no means to do either of those things. The family policing system will not provide childcare. The family policing system does not provide money. So that child goes into foster care when all that family needed was daycare, a way to pay for their child to be cared for while that parent is at work. So the family policing system doesn't provide any form of help to anyone.
This next one is for Maya. Maya, you mentioned earlier about working with people who have been placed in the foster system. When children are separated from their parents, this is the myth. When children are separated from their parents, they live in safe and loving foster homes. Maya.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is a myth that is interesting, right? Because I think that most people don't think that foster care is a great place. You know, there's a lot of narratives about like how foster care is not a great place. There's movies about it, you know, stories about the horrors of foster care, bad things that happen. But I think that there is still, what's still prevalent is this idea that even though foster care might not be a great place, it's certainly better than where children came from originally, right? Like, it still has its purpose. And there's also this narrative of how altruistic it is to be a foster parent and or an adoptive parent and take, you know, children into your home that, quote unquote, didn't have anywhere else to go. And the reality is that not only, one, is the trauma of separation obviously devastating for both parents and their children, but abuse is widespread in foster care. The youth that I worked with were often, you know, living out of trash bags, didn't know where they were going to go the next night. And we're talking about people who are literally under government surveillance. So the fact that you could be in such precarious situations while you are supposedly in a caring and loving environment that is not your original home is honestly very wild to think about. But I think the other thing that happens often is, especially when we're talking about Black youth, when we're talking about queer youth, when we're talking about Native youth, like the nature of the placements that they are going into. So whether that be congregate care facilities is their foster care, very dangerous group homes where they can't get gender-affirming care, or maybe they're in foster homes where they're not able to express themselves fully. Maybe they're in foster homes as a Black kid and they're in a really racist foster home. I think that all of these situations aren't really quantified in the same way when we think about foster care as this like safe and loving place that is a great alternative for kids who can't otherwise be at home. So I will say that while this myth is a little bit dispelled in our culture, I think that the true breadth of experience that people are going through in foster care often falls under the radar or is rationalized in that, well, at least they're not in that crazy environment that they came from.
Thanks, Maya. Josie, I'm going to pitch this one to you. You talked about your work with mutual aid orgs. So the myth, parents are offered services to address their needs.
Well, I think that Alan kind of answered this, but I will add that when people ask me about this work and abolishing the system, how is that possible? What does that look like? I always tell them, think about the most well-resourced communities that you know, often white communities, and what do they have in them? They have services, access to services. If there is a substance use issue in the home, they have access to care for that. If there are issues that might need counseling services, they have access to that kind of help. So when we're thinking about that, that is what I imagine as an abolitionist future. And that's just not what the family policing system does. Alan talked about, you know, if a parent needs childcare, you know, if a parent needs access to food, the family policing system doesn't send that family to a community fridge or a place where they might have that access. Anything that you think, most things that you think families might endure and need assistance with, they do not receive that assistance through the family policing system. And this is something that I think is important to talk to when we talk, have conversations with people that we call mandated reporters or people who are reporting into the system, because a lot of people do believe that this is a helping system and that the families that they refer, quote unquote, will have those services happen to them. But you might have a parent who needs childcare or food access, and that parent will end up having to take parenting classes as opposed to having those needs met. And then if they are unable to make those parenting classes, and then, you know, something so small as just, I need help feeding my kid, will mean that that child will end up separated from their entire family and community, end up in the foster system, and sometimes may never gain access to their family again. So, yeah, it's what Alan said earlier, and it just happens in almost every case, even if we're thinking about issues that are a little bit more challenging, like the issues that I mentioned earlier with, you know, if there's a substance use issue or a mental health issue. What does it look like to bring community care in that? We understand fully that that kind of help just does not come through the family policing system.
Thank you. Okay, last myth. Although racial disproportionality exists, this is largely due to disparities in poverty. So I'm going to pitch this one to Alan, who's studied this a lot, the racial disproportionality.
So just quickly, racial disproportionality kind of is what it sounds like, but it's the fact that most of the children in foster care are Black, Indigenous, or Latinx children. And really, of that group, disproportionality impacts Black children the most. Nationally, Black children represent somewhere between 35 and 40% of all children in foster care, even though they're only about 10% of children in the population. So the child welfare system forcibly separates Black children at a much higher rate than any other group of children. And if you're really in, like, deeply involved in the, this is one of the myths that probably isn't as widely known, but if you're in this work, you know that there is a small but very vocal, very powerful group of white scholars who have made it their life mission to try to say that the child welfare system is not racist. Likely because they've spent decades studying that system and promoting how great and wonderful that system is for children that they've studied for those decades. But they will very openly say that the child welfare system is not racist. Caseworkers are not racist. The only reason that disproportionality exists is because of differences in poverty rates. And what they try to obscure is the fact that Black children, Indigenous children, Latinx children are more likely to be living in poverty than white children. But why is that the case? Because of centuries of structural and institutional racism in this country, and because of racist policies that white legislators have put into place to ensure that Black families are overrepresented in poverty. So yes, poverty is a predictor of child welfare involvement, like we just talked about. It's the vast majority of kids in the system. But the reason those children are in poverty is because of specific government policies that have been put in place really since the abolition of slavery, going back to the Black Codes, Jim Crow laws, all of those kind of things. Even when you look at the history of the child welfare system, the history of the child welfare system started immediately after abolition of slavery and has contained or has built on racist policies, mandatory reporting, policies that allow termination of children, of parents' rights from their children. So the system itself is deeply embedded with racist ideas that largely operate from the point of view of a white parenting standard, white middle class parenting standard that all other families are judged against. But there is, like I said, a very active group of white scholars who push against that, particularly in social work spaces, that really try to perpetuate this myth and are successful at it because of the status that they've had or they've earned over decades of work.
Racism perpetuating itself, right? So now that we've dispelled some of those myths and really did some level setting about the family policing system, let's talk about the movement to abolish the family policing system. So for everyone, I think it's also important, again, one of our objectives today is to situate the family policing movement. So how does the family policing system fit into the larger movement to abolish carceral systems? Josie?
Hi. I think it's exactly what we've all been saying, is that this is a policing system. It is a system that is based and that happens in the same ways that our traditional carceral system works, right? There's surveillance, there's punishment, there are police organizations that work with those who work in family policing to separate families. We are having so many conversations around the nation about why it's important for parents to be Mirandized and to understand that they have rights when it comes to allowing caseworkers and many times, oftentimes, police to enter their homes. Like, we're having the same conversations. I can tell you, as someone who grew up during the quote-unquote war on drugs, in the same way that my community was overrun with police, my community also experienced these large numbers of family separations. And I think growing up, I didn't understand that. But now that I have been studying the family policing system and its very racist origins, whether we're talking about colonization or whether we're talking about the legacy of slavery in this country, I realize now more and more how much it ties together. I think this is something that we explored. I'm going to plug our podcast here, the Up In Podcast, which the first season really kind of focuses on this history and focuses on these connections. We actually delve into Alan's amazing book that talks about the history of the family policing system and why abolition is the only way forward. Actually, this new season that starts next month for us is going to talk about not only how the family policing system is connected to the traditional policing system, but also how it's connected to so many other justice movements that we are working to abolish and change and transform. And so I think that sums it up. We could go into so much more, but I think that would take up the entire panel, talking about all of the connections, but they are absolutely there. And the best way to describe it is to think about really the connections between surveillance and punishment and how that exists in the family policing system in the same way that it exists in the traditional policing system.
Thanks, Josie. And for anyone wanting to know more about the podcast, on page 32 of the program, you can find out how to connect to the Upend podcast. And again, just that very, very comprehensive look at from now then till now. Related to family policing abolition and the larger abolition movement, at UpIn, we've been thinking about solidarity a lot, especially in the wake of the ongoing genocide of Gaza and the occupation of Palestine. So I just want to ask each panelist, what does solidarity mean to each of you as abolitionists focused on family policing?
I think this is a super important question as abolitionists. And I'll tell a really quick story to kind of bring this one to life of how it impacted us. Very early in Israel's assault on Palestine, around mid-October, October 15th, October 16th, UpIn released a statement in solidarity with Palestine, and to give credit, written largely by Kanis and by Sydney, our comms people. And we got a lot of pushback about that statement from other family policing abolitionists who said, why are you talking about Palestine? This has nothing to do with family policing or the child welfare system. You need to stay in your lane or you're going to alienate people. One person even said to me, I don't understand why you're talking about this. I'm a single issue abolitionist. Okay, so I could get, like, you all know how problematic that is. There's no such thing as a single-issue abolitionist. If those of us who kind of lead this work like we do with a focus on family policing, if we're successful in abolishing the family policing system, even if we're successful in abolishing family policing, abolishing prisons, the police in the United States, but there is still prisons, policing, occupations, genocide happening everywhere else in the world, we will have accomplished nothing. Like, the child welfare in the United States has nothing to do with, like, the big movement. It's just one very small aspect of what we're trying to do as abolitionists. I think those of us who live in the U.S., you know, we're socialized from the time we're born to have these very xenophobic ideas that we should only care about what happens to kids in the U.S., but that's not the way that the abolition movement is organized. So what's happening in Palestine is very relevant to family policing abolition, really going back to the idea that we're not free until, or no one's free until everybody's free. We all have to be working on liberation, freedom of everyone. Some of us lead with family policing, some of us lead with prison, some of us lead with policing, but all of this work is connected, and the work isn't done until all forms of oppression, occupation, genocide are ended.
Go ahead, Maya. Yeah, I think thanks, Alan, for bringing up. I think in this space, obviously in this movement, it has been difficult to try to make these parallels. And that's not to say that no one is making them, but I think, like Alan is saying, that there's a significant amount of pushback to making parallels, especially in, I think, this system where so much of it is built off of, like, social work and these, like, very, like, ingrained concepts that it's just, like, what does one have to do with the other? But I think, for me, the clearest connections between not only the occupation of Palestine, but also just, like, why this system is and should be a part of our larger movements to abolish carceral systems is because the enemy is the same, right? Like, we are all collectively fighting against the same enemy. So I don't understand how we could think that the same government that is actively killing and starving millions of people, some of whom, many of whom are children, could also be involved in the safety and protection of children in the United States. Like, the logic doesn't really hold. And I think also, obviously, the parallels between the way that surveillance technology has been, you know, tried out and tested time and time again under the occupation, and how those same practices and surveillance technologies come back here and vice versa, right? Like, these governments are trading their very skilled and adept surveillance mechanisms and their policing mechanisms and just mechanisms of repression. And, like, what does it mean to starve a community? I think, like, when we're talking about the communities that are coming into contact with the family policing system, these are also communities that are literally being starved. These are communities that are facing horrific violence every single day. And understanding that this logic is flowing very freely between these entities that believe that they can do this to certain communities. So I think, as much as possible, as we can, you know, broaden our movements and really understand, like, who the enemy is and what we're fighting against and what it will take to end that, I think our movements gain so much from that and become so much stronger. And obviously, you know, solidarity between Black liberation and Palestinian liberation has been around forever. But that is important, right? Because we are literally, the same way that they're trading secrets and technology, we're trading strategies for liberation. And I think that's really important to learn from each other and to grow our political consciousness in a way that says, not only can we learn, not only are we not free till everybody's free, but our enemies are the same. And so I'm as invested in, you know, the United States ending the oppression of Palestinians as the ending the oppression of families here in the child welfare system. Because if one ends, I'm confident, or I'm at least hopeful, that the oppression of the other follows.
What she said. But also, and I have to big up the Socialism Conference of 2023. I don't know if any of you all were at last year's Socialism Conference, but one of the keynote speakers or the keynote panel included Angela Davis. And one of the things that Angela Davis focused on before everything that has happened since October was the importance of abolitionists to be internationalists. And also understanding fully that idea, and quote, like, if they come for you in the morning, they're coming for me at night. I cannot say that I care about families and communities and children and put a stipulation and an asterisk that says only within the United States. I have to, if I am committed to caring about humanity, I have to care about all of humanity. And it's a hard, hard thing right now as the world is burning. As we are seeing what is happening not only in Palestine, but as we're watching what's happening in Sudan, the Congo, in Haiti, in all of these places. I think that there is room for us to care about all of these things. And all of these things are connected when we're talking about destroying communities, whether we're talking about here or abroad. We are, as Maya said, talking about a common enemy, and we have to come up with common solutions. And the only way that we can do that is being internationalist and really committing to solidarity. I was so surprised and shocked by the responses that we received when we put out that statement in solidarity, because I was confused. I thought to myself, how can you say that you are standing for liberation in any way, standing for connectivity and humanity in any way, and not say no to this immediately? But I became very surprised about, you know, how some folks think. And really, I think it's a lack of political education, which is something that we're trying to address through things that we're writing and thinking about and through the podcast and things that we share. And when we are coalition building with other organizers.
Yeah, I just want to add on to that a little bit. Along with everyone here, everyone on the Up In team, I was very saddened by the response that we got after the statement on Palestine. I started off being sad, but then I got really clear. I got really clear because the ahistoricalness of it all, right? The fact that Black liberations have been in solidarity with Palestine literally for decades, and the fact that people did not know that, it made it very clear, like, what part of our work is throughout abolitionist spaces. All right, so Maya mentioned a common enemy. Let's talk about a common problem. A huge part of maintaining carceral systems is racial capitalism. Can you speak to the way racial capitalism necessitates the existence of the family policing system, and why ending capitalism must be part of the movement to abolish family policing?
There's a lot of intersections with this, but I think the biggest one is going back to the origins of the family policing system and why the family policing system exists. And the reality of that, without going deeply into the history because we don't have time for that, but the reality is the family policing exists in order to maintain an exploitable labor class that racial capitalism depends on. When the family policing system forcibly separates Black children from their families and disproportionately at great numbers forcibly separates Black children from their families, the result of that is that then those children go into foster care, and the outcomes of foster care for children who spend time in foster care, those children then are much more likely than other children to be incarcerated as adults, to be living in poverty as adults, to have mental health problems as adults, to have substance use problems as adults, to not graduate from high school. the problems that result from foster care are enormous, but they're also the same exact issues that maintain oppression of Black and brown people in this country more broadly. When the state forcibly separates Black and brown children from their families, it makes it all the more likely that those conditions that maintain oppression are going to be realized. So the system is responsible for maintaining Black and brown people at the bottom, the exploitable labor class, and the white people who run the system at the top. And that's what capitalism depends on. But I know Maya always answers this question the best. So I'll turn it over to her. Because I most of my ideas about racial capitalism in the system came from Maya.
No, I mean, I all of that, that's right. And I think also, again, and figuring out, like, where are the parallels, where are the connections between the prison system, between the child welfare system, family policing system, and all of these other systems, it's like, well, where else are people going to go when they're living in these precarious positions, right? Like, the prison system is made up, if you look at who these systems are serving, and I use that very loosely, more so capturing, if you look at who these systems are capturing, they are people who are poor in extremely economically precarious situations, and they're mostly Black, they're mostly Native, they're mostly Latinx. And so I think that one, the connections between capitalism and the system are that the reasons why people can't have what they need and come into the systems in the first place, the reasons why families don't have housing, the reasons why they don't have food, the reasons why people are forced to, you know, prioritize earning their income at some job over being with their family or taking care of their family, you know, the reasons why people don't even have access to mental health services, or they don't have, the reasons why maybe people struggle with their mental health in the first place, right? Like, capitalism is creating these conditions that then become ripe for the state to come in and quote unquote save them. But in reality, as Alan is describing, obviously we know that it's also maintaining this permanent, you know, racially stratified, economically stratified underclass. But in this system in particular, the reasons that people come into contact with this system are literally manifested by capitalism, and then they are punished for experiencing it in the first place. And so I think that, you know, there's still some hesitation around capitalism and talking about capitalism in our movement, and thinking that, you know, like, if we just had more social programs, like, you know, maybe it wouldn't be so bad, or maybe less families like would come into contact with the system in the first place. But I think that we really have to understand that the reason that people are here in the first place are because of the conditions that are created by capitalism. And that means that we actually have to end and transform those conditions.
I don't feel like I have a lot to add. Alan and Maya summed that up so greatly, but I just think about how the root of capitalism is the lie that we are told around individualism, and how we are all supposed to operate in this space of individualism. When we think about the way that the family policing system works, parents are punished again and seen as these individuals who make these individual quote-unquote mistakes, and their mistakes are their responsibility alone. Because that is what capitalism teaches us, right? Instead of looking at these families from a communal standpoint to say that, oh, you are struggling, you are suffering, how can we help? We realize that there are many things in play that have gotten you into the situation that you're in. And so let's look at all of these individual things and figure out how to help in a communal way. So I just wanted to add, like, that idea of, like, individualism and how it is pushed as a part of this capitalist agenda that we never really talk about enough. And part of our dreaming and our imagination around a future outside of family policing is bringing the ability and control to help back to communities and families. That's all I had to add.
Thank you, Josie. Speaking of dreaming and imagining, one thing to add to what Josie just said is also like the remembrance that it wasn't always this way. This is not how communities, indigenous communities, cared for each other. This is really new to us, right? So there's a remembrance, there's also a reclaiming aspect. So in that vein, let's talk about it. Let's talk about building. Abolition is about presence, not absence. It's about building life-affirming institutions. That's Ruth Wilson Gilmore. So understanding that the family policing system exacts known and untold harm on Black, Native, and increasingly Latinx children and families, let's talk about what children and families do need. So beyond the systems we currently have, what would care in a post-family policing system world look like? In other words, what does non-carceral, non-punitive care look like? And I hate to do this, Josie, but I'm going to pitch it back to you.
Pitch it back to me. I think I spoke about this earlier when I said, hey, what happens in well-resourced families when they need help? They get help. And there isn't a whole lot of judgment around why they need help. They just get the help that they need to make sure that their families stay together and communities pitch in. I have a friend who, since her child, and I don't know why, to one of these like very wealthy kind of schools. And when there are issues happening within the schools with students and families, let's be honest, they're not reporting to the family policing system. They don't have caseworkers showing up at their doors. Everyone in that community, including those systems, meaning school workers and so forth, the goal is reaching into community and figuring out how can we resolve this problem so there's the least amount of chatter possible, the least amount of effect possible, and the most help that we can find possible. That's what I imagine that every family should have. That is what I imagine every child should have. That's just straight up my imagining. I mean, outside of a world outside of capitalism where we don't have to fight for resources and everybody gets what they need, which I guess is connected to what I'm saying. And I think the question that I ask when people say, you know, my abolitionist dreams are impossible, I ask them, why do we feel that some people deserve that and some people don't? That's the real question. The question isn't whether abolition is possible. The question isn't whether we can dream or imagine what that looks like. We have examples right in front of us of what it looks like. The question that we have to answer is, why do we think Black folks, brown folks, indigenous folks don't deserve that kind of help and care? And until we really get to the root of answering that question, which I think, you know, Alan has answered. Alan, don't make me chop up your book, but I know you won't say it out loud, and I want to say it. Confronting the racist legacy. Confronting the racist legacy of the child welfare system, a case for abolition. Look that up. Alan would never plug his own book, but I'm telling you, reading that book and working on podcast episodes where we explored all of the chapters in that book has given me so much understanding of the why. Understanding of how to answer that question. And I think it'll help you too if you are interested in that. But that's the question. I always answer questions with questions with folks who question me about abolition. So I just think that that's the answer. Like, if we're going to dream forward, we need to dream forward and know that what we're dreaming about is possible. And not only is it possible, it's tangible because certain people are already living that dream. And we need to figure out why we don't think every single person in the world should have the opportunity to live just like that.
Maya, can you,
I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit. Can you answer that question from the lens of how UpEnd approached that question in the document that we put out, How We End Up?
Yeah, I think that UpEnd has a document which is sort of like our musings on what does it look like to end this system and what are some potentials to build something better or build another world and what would that look like? What does care look like? I think that there's a few ways to think about it. And some are not really that complicated, right? It's about taking care of each other, but like more concretely about thinking like, what does it mean to feed communities? I'm thinking of Erica. Is that a community garden in your neighborhood where people can come and get whatever they need? Is that making sure that you are important in a child's life, and maybe you're not a parent? I think about this a lot because I'm not a parent and I'm, you know, involved in this work that's very heavily focused on parenting and care. But I think a lot of it is thinking about like, what does it mean to actually be communal in the way that we think about children and the way that we raise children? How do we, one, support parents, but how do we show up for kids that aren't even our kids? You know, I think a lot of what this system tells us is obviously, you know, nuclear family models, that's what's important, and that's how people get support and care. But I think also that we can collectively build now and act now in ways that sort of build out this future and experiment like with what works. So does that mean like offering your friend childcare on a Friday night? I don't know. It could. So I think that a lot of this is literally giving ourselves the opportunity to experiment about different things that are working for our communities. I think every community looks different. Like my community looks different than many of your communities, and what those needs are is different. But I also think that so often, especially as the people who are like, no, everything sucks, like we have to build something more, people really want concrete alternatives all the time, which really annoys me because I think that part of this work is giving ourselves the freedom to maybe be like, I don't know, but I'm willing to try this and like see what happens. And so I think like some things are, you know, more concrete. Like we talk about reparations in that document. We talk about more specifically giving reparations out to people that have been harmed by this system so that they can perhaps actually get on their feet and get what they need. But I think another part of this is experimental, and I think it is playing around with things that we might, you know, have imaginations about and what might work and what doesn't work. I also think that care looks a lot like, and we talk about this a little bit in that document too, is really reorienting ourselves and how we view children in this society. I think that often as a room full of adults, as adults, there are a lot of negative ideas about what it means to be a child, how we talk to children, how we treat children, what does child autonomy look like? And I think that excitingly, you know, moving towards abolishing the system means that we actually get to experiment with those things. Like, what do kids think care looks like? Like, that's what I want to know, and that's what I want to see. And so, I think I get really excited about this stuff because after we talked about a bunch of terrible things, I do think that there is so much opportunity. And like we said, like, this stuff is new. Like, we don't have to live like this. We haven't always lived like this. And I just think that there's so many opportunities that arise from saying, like, we don't want this. What can we build? And what does it look like? And so giving ourselves permission to maybe not know but experiment with what might work.
Yes, snaps. Yes, yes. Maya, thinking about children as children in communal care, I just could not help but think about the James Baldwin quote that says, the children are always ours. Every single one of them, all over the globe. Alan, did you have anything to add to that line? Okay, all right. All right, so now that we've kind of did some level setting, we've dreamed a little, we've talked about possible alternatives, let's kind of get real. We often get very real questions from people about what should we do when harm does occur. So can you share thoughts about how we handle harm in a world that doesn't rely on family policing?
Alan.
Well, I'll start this one with a plug for another paper that UpIn just started called Reclaiming Safety. As Kanis mentioned, since we started UpIn in 2020, Maya, me, Josie, other people present about UpIn and the abolishing family policing system often, and particularly like to schools of social work, because I work in a school of social work, and so that's kind of allowed access to other schools of social work. And as you can probably imagine, the most common question that we get is, well, if there's no child welfare system, what happens to children who are really harmed? I think it's important to say, you know, first, those are intended to be gotcha questions, because the people who ask those questions know that most of the children in the system have not been harmed, that they're in the system because of poverty-related issues. And what those questions do is that it shuts down the conversation about building and imagining, because you focus on this horrifically harmed child. One person even asked me, well, what if this 2-year-old baby, both of his arms were broken and both of his legs were broken? Then what should happen? And the answer is, I don't know what should happen, but I know what we shouldn't do. I know that we shouldn't do things to that child and that family that cause more harm. And we know that in every situation, forcibly separating children from their families causes harm. It causes harm to those children, it causes harm to the families, it causes harm to those communities. So we start with what we shouldn't do. We're working on building out a series of papers right now called Reclaiming Safety. Me, Maya, and another person we work with, Angela Burton, just wrote kind of the intro to this series. It's available at our website, upinmovement.org. And we're going to take time over the next year to look at, because child maltreatment harm is a complicated issue, we're going to look very specifically at issues of physical harm, sexual harm, what should happen to children in homes where there's substance use, mental health concerns, interpersonal violence. So those are all forthcoming. But I think the idea is that we need to experiment, as Maya said, and we need to look at ways of supporting each other, or families and communities being first responders instead of the state being a first responder because of what we know the harm that's caused. When I talk to people who aren't really familiar with the idea of abolition, what I usually say to them is to think about your own family. Think about your own network of people that you love and care about, and imagine that a child in that network is harmed. What would you want to happen? Would you want to get together as a family and a community and figure out what should happen to prevent further harm from happening? Or would you want the state to come in and take that child away from you and figure it out? And I think most people, when posed with that question, would pick the first option, to figure it out for themselves. But this goes back to the idea of solidarity then. If you want that option for you and your family, then you should want that option for every family. And if you want that option for every family, then you're an abolitionist. That's the kind of thing that we're looking at here when we talk about what should happen.
I can answer this very personally. I recently had a friend who experienced intimate partner violence with someone who is a mother. And we had to have conversations, really hard conversations, about what to do. Do we involve police? Do we report this violence to CPS? And of course, I made space for her to make the decisions that she felt was best for her. But one of the ways that I showed up, which I was very proud of, and which I know I probably would not have done before really diving deep into this work, is to be very clear that what this person needs is help. They're not going to receive that help in a prison system. UpIn is based in Houston, Texas. I live in Houston, Texas. This person very clearly needs mental, emotional help, assistance. Harris County Jail in Houston is the biggest provider of mental health services in the city, and I believe in the state, if I'm not mistaken. What that says to me is that a lot of people who are in prison need mental and emotional health care. And prison probably isn't the answer to that. And what they usually receive when they're in prison is medication and not any type of resources for counseling and therapy and all of these things that are really going to make change in their lives and the lives around them. And then there was the question of, well, should I report? I said, well, what evidence do you have in reporting? And what other options do you have outside of reporting? Are you connected to this person's friends, families? Like, what are some other ways that we can look at making sure that this child is safe outside of pushing her into a system that means that not only will she be separated from her mother, she will also be separated from her entire family, very likely. She might end up in foster care where she will have an even worse experience than whatever you're imagining she's experiencing now. I don't know that I would have had all of that information to share with her or to help her think through before. And so that really is the answer. We are human beings, and human beings harm. And I think that it is just very important for us to think, I am able to do exactly what Alan said. If I was in this position, what would I want for my family? What would I want for this child if this child was my child? And I think that that is the beginning and the end of it, is to think about, like, what are some alternatives and what are some options? Because we understand that human beings are human and some humans will harm. But that doesn't mean that a child should be completely taken away from their entire family and community. There are ways to heal harm. And I think that conversations around what transformative justice and all of these conversations that can be communal conversations and that we can have happen in community is really a way forward. And it's a much, much better option than continuing to place people in systems that we know just do not help.
Josie, thank you so much for getting real and personal. Because I think that for a lot of us in the room who've thought about this, read about this, written about this, and I'm not going to ask for a show of hands, but as Josie told that story, just note for yourself, I just want to name that as she walked through those steps of not calling the police, of not engaging the system, right? What did you feel about that? Was there any resistance, right, that you felt? And if there was, that's just the extent to which we all have to keep decarcerating our mind. Because it's odd to hear that in real time when you don't do what society tells us to do. Even though we know all that we know and read all that we've read and believe what we believe, we still have to continually engage in the work of decarcerating our own minds. Let's see. Maya, did you have anything to add there?
I mean, I think I would just say that I think in a lot of ways, abolition is an admission that we don't respond to harm particularly well as a society, and oftentimes we don't actually know what to do. And I, like, literally what you are saying and trying to figure it out given your politics and given what you know about these systems is that I think we have to be very honest about, in a lot of ways, we don't know what to do, and it is hard to even lean on alternatives when they don't already exist, right? Like, and sometimes they're here, sometimes they're not. And I think that this question, more than any of the other questions that we get about abolition, when it's not meant to just be a gotcha question, I think it's really important that we take very seriously that, you know, harm does occur. It's occurring all the time. It's occurring frequently. And just because we don't want the state to intervene doesn't mean that we can pretend like, you know, we live in a la-la land where harm is not happening. And so I struggle with this a lot. But I think that, and I believe that, we can figure out a way to respond to harm that doesn't further victimize people, that doesn't further put people in worse positions, and doesn't destroy families. But I just want to admit that we're really struggling with these questions, and we're attempting to come together to answer them. But I do think that it's really important that we take seriously harm that occurs to, you know, victims across the board.
Thanks for naming that, Maya. Alan, speaking of reporting, you've been a very vocal critic of social work and the role that social work plays in perpetuating harmful systems. For social workers, what is their role in both the movement to end family policing and in a post-family policing world?
I think the really important part of that goes back to kind of our first question and this myth-busting idea, is to understand that just as the child welfare system is not a helping system, neither is the profession of social work. Social work does not help people for the most part. There are some people who are helped by social workers, but when you look broadly at the profession, even going back to its history with Jane Addams and the settlement houses, all of that, it's built on a model of behavioral modification and social control for the purpose of white people's comfort. And that's what social workers still do today. I'm a critic of social work because of the dissonance between what social work purports to be and the way that social workers actually practice. If you look at our code of ethics says that social workers should work to end all forms of racism, oppression, discrimination, and inequities. If we really believe that, that means that we should remove ourselves and work to end the systems that are responsible for racism, oppression, discrimination, and inequities. But we don't. We largely endorse the family policing system. In fact, the position of the National Association of Social Workers, our professional body, is that every caseworker who works in the family policing system should at minimum have an undergraduate social work degree. So the profession says that this system should be entirely comprised of social workers, entirely comprised in the business of forcibly separating children from their parents. The system maintains the idea that the solution to police violence is for social workers to walk hand in hand into communities with the police, the very people who are responsible for brutalizing and terrorizing those communities, and that that somehow is going to make things better. What social workers need to do is completely remove ourselves from these systems. The way that these systems have kept social workers in these systems for decades is with what I think is the myth of creating change from the inside. Social workers think they need to be in these systems, they think they need to be in prisons, cooperating with the police, because we can create change from the inside. Creating change from the inside is a lie that white people want us to believe, so we'll stay working in their systems and contributing to the harm that these systems causes. There is no creating change from the inside. It just doesn't work. So we could say, as social workers, we've tried to create change from the inside, and it was a miserable failure. And now we need to just acknowledge that it didn't work, and we need to get out. So our role should be as abolitionists. If social workers really believe in what we say we believe in, ending oppression, discrimination, racism, and inequities, we should be getting out of these systems and working from the outside to abolish all of them. Anything other than that makes the profession just performative nonsense, because it's not at all living up to what it says it's supposed to be doing.
I'm going to keep the mic, Alan. I'm going to project. One of the things that I think is really interesting that a lot of people don't realize, that I didn't realize, is, can you talk a little bit about the connection with capitalism there and how people are literally paid to, their educations are funded so that they can go into social work and become another arm of the carceral state?
Yeah, I mean, that's something, another thing that social workers need to be working to end, but the federal government has a program that's called 4E programs. 4E, it's based on the Social Security Act, Title 4E in the Social Security Act, that gives millions of dollars to schools of social work to offset the education of bachelor's and master's level social workers so that they will go into work to work for the child welfare system. So what this, what schools do is schools of social work really prey on black and brown students who can't otherwise afford an education and say, we will pay for your master's degree, we'll pay for your undergraduate degree, and then you have to go work for the child welfare system, family policing system, for usually a period of like an equivalent period of years or months. So if you're in the program for 2 years, then you have to go work for the system for 2 years. So it's literally like indentured servitude. It's like forced labor. And for many people, the capitalism issue is that getting a college education, getting a master's degree is incredibly expensive, and it's not accessible to people. It's the same way that the military gets people to go into the military. It's the exact same idea, which also preys on black and brown people who can't afford a college education. If you go into the military, you'll get free college. This is it's the same system that schools of social work do. So schools of social work are complicit in taking hundreds of thousands of dollars from the government to give that money to students who are then forced to go work for the system. And then those schools of social work tell these students that they're doing good. Then that's part of the brainwashing, that you're going to help families, you're going to save children from these horrific aspects of harm. All of that needs to stop. Like, government subsidizing people to be forced to go work into the system is a large part of the problem. And it's another way that social work is complicit in it, because it's taking all this money. I literally got fired from being dean of my school of social work. A big part of it was because the people who run this program at my school felt that the state wasn't going to give us this money anymore because of me talking about abolishing this system. I mean, it's like that. So these schools of social work depend on this money that deeply, because it employs a number of staff. It gives those faculty money. I mean, it's just a huge government program to maintain this form of carcerality, and schools of social work are complicit in doing this.
Thanks for listening. If you liked this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.